to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 20th of January, 2020. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. It's the start of another week, and you know what that means? It means that I must have my co-host here from Western Spring, Mr. Max Musson. Max, good afternoon to you, sir. How are you doing?
I'm very well indeed, thank you. What about yourself?
Yeah, pretty good. It's a very, very crisp, frosty winter's morning today. Sun's shining finally after lots of rain. It's always nice to have that winter sun there. Unfortunately, we haven't really got any particularly positive news stories to get into to accompany the good weather. We had two reports that came out last week that I want to get into, and I did talk a little bit about the first one, the Manchester report, on the Daily Nationalist last week, but it hadn't actually come out that the reason why the Asian pedophile gangs weren't arrested is because the police were frightened of being accused of being racist. The report had only just come out on the BBC at the time when I spoke about it, and some more information has come out about that since then. And we've also had a report out from Rotherham that I want to get into. This first Manchester report, I've got this information, comes from Breitbart. A report commissioned by the Mayor of Greater Manchester found that police systematically overlooked crimes committed by an Asian grooming gang for fear of appearing racist. In the early 2000s, a grooming gang comprised of 97 men from South Asian backgrounds was able to roam free in Manchester, abusing at least 57 young girls, as members of the Greater Manchester Police were told to focus on apprehending offenders of other ethnicities. What had a massive input was the offending target group were predominantly Asian males, and we were told to try and get other ethnicities, said an unnamed GMP detective constable per the Telegraph. Members of the Asian pedophile ring sexually abused young girls, used drugs to make their victims compliant, leading to the death of a 15-year-old girl, Victoria Agolia, who was injected with heroin by a 50-year-old man, leading to an overdose which killed her in 2003. At the time of her death, Agolia was under the care of Manchester City Council, which the report claims was privy to multiple threats, sexual assaults, and serious sexual exploitation allegations. The report admits the council did nothing to prevent her death and that her murderer remains unpunished to this day. In 2017, the counter-extremism think tank Quilliam found that 84% of those connected in grooming gang crimes in the United Kingdom were Muslim men with South Asian roots. The report, which documented testimonies from grooming gang members during court proceedings, found that the men calculatedly targeted white girls for their sexual abuse as they were seen as easy targets, compared to girls from their own communities who they felt should be protected. And of course, this is the same story that we heard from Rotherham. And you think this is 20 years ago. Now, what was happening 20 years ago, around about this time, from what I can remember and from what I've seen online, the BNP were trying to highlight this problem. The BNP were trying to say, we have a problem with this Muslim community here. A large portion of them are going out there and grooming our young girls and grooming them and raping them and trafficking them. And the BNP were accused of being racist. And I think Mark Cullett and Nick Griffin were taken to court for hate speech. And all along, they were speaking the truth. This is exactly what was going on. And now we've got the police saying, well, we apologize for this. This was absolutely terrible. But they're still going after the people that are pointing out the crimes that the immigrant communities are carrying out. They're still going after the whistleblowers. So they haven't really learned anything. They're just, you know, it's just words. I want to see some action here that they're going to start protecting these girls and they're going to stop attacking the people that are whistleblowing and that are saying that this is a problem that is going on. And I was also encouraged to see that Britain First have actually gone to these areas with these leaflets with a phone number on there, and they've gone to mosques, taxi taxi driver places and also hotels with this sheet of paper saying, if you see any evidence of grooming, anything like this, call this phone number or call the police. And what they're basically saying is people need to be watching out for this. They need to be watching out for groups of Asian men with young white girls. And they should be either contacting the police or contacting Britain First, who they themselves will then contact the police. And of course, they've gone to a mosque to talk about this, and they filmed it. And the mosque guy was quite happy to take the sheet of paper, because you would imagine that the Muslim community would also want to see a stop to this. They don't want to be tarred with this image of being grooming gangs. But unfortunately, they are, because that's what they've been doing. That's what the facts are. 84% Quilliam have said, and I've also heard it said that it was 92%, I think Sajid Javid said, a while back. So now it's come out that it's all political correctness is the reason why these crimes weren't investigated. And the same thing is happening today. Political correctness is preventing a solution being found to the knife crime epidemic in London. It's preventing a solution being found to the acid attack epidemic in London. And we've still got all these problems with grooming gangs. There was that Mirror report that said it could be even up to 1 million girls have actually been groomed and trafficked by these gangs. And of course, they're young white girls, and the young white girls are just being thrown under the bus for political correctness. And I hate the fact that we are having to repeat this, because we were talking about it last year, we were talking about it the year before, and I've no doubt even more reports are going to come out from Telford and from Rochdale, and this isn't going to go away until something is done about it. Max, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think that it's something that's not just repeated itself, it's repeated itself and repeated itself and repeated itself. If there was just one town where this happened, and it happened once, and then it was stopped, that would be one thing. But what we've seen over the last 20 years or so is that this has been happening in virtually every large town and city across the country. And each time the news media and the police react as if, this is something which is entirely new. It's almost like they comment on it, it's almost as if this has never happened before, and they're totally puzzled as to how they should react to it. When in reality, what's happened is this has happened on a very systematic basis, as I say, in virtually every large town and city across the country. And so it is a problem which has now reached the kind of size where somebody like the Home Secretary ought to step in and demand that there is some kind of investigation amongst chief police officers, who presumably are the ones who decide what the political slant is going to be in their particular area, the area of the country that they cover, and some sort of investigation needs to be held to find out who the people are that actually were turning a blind eye each time. Because in my view, what's been going on is worse than negligence. If it was happening in one place, you could say, it was just negligence on the part of two or three police officers who weren't properly trained, who didn't really know what they were doing. But in fact, it's been happening systematically all over the country, to a point where it isn't just an odd occurrence. What it is that it's systematic. And that suggests that there has been some kind of widespread instruction to the police that they are not to investigate these kind of crimes in the interests of race relations. In reality, what's happening here is corruption for political ends. The Labour Party back at the beginning of the 2000s were opening the doors to far greater levels of mass immigration than had existed before. It was done. There was a whistleblower from the Labour Party who said that this was being done deliberately, that mass immigration was being encouraged into the UK in order to bring about a social change, so that there would be so many ethnic minorities in the UK that it would be impossible to reverse. And it was being done in order to rub the noses of the right in multiculturalism. And so there was a deliberate act on the part of the government in those days to promote multiracialism, multiculturalism and mass immigration. And in order not to throw a spanner in the works of that government campaign of immigration, it would appear that chief police officers all over the country were instructed not to or to underreport ethnic minority crime, and where crimes of this sort, this really distressing and disgusting crimes of this sort were taking place, to turn a blind eye to them and just let the people committing those crimes get away with it.
They actually withdrew the resources. And this is the shocking thing. They had all the information on this, particularly on this 50-year-old man that eventually injected this girl with heroin and murdered her at age 15. They had all the information on them, and the resources were withdrawn from somewhere. Who was it that withdrew those resources? What was the reason for that? As you say, Max, that there's a pattern here. We can see a pattern. We can see it occurring in every place where this has gone on. The crimes have been covered up. They in effect gave a pass card. They gave a get out of jail free card to the communities responsible for doing this. And the excuse that they came up with was, well, we don't want to upset community cohesion. And to be honest, I mean, what I think that's what they're frightened of. They are frightened of cohesion among the white community in resisting this. And that's what needs to happen, because if they don't properly investigate this, then they're just going to be seen as, well, we've got one law for them and we've got one law for the others. And once again, it's the white man and it's the white man's children that are suffering from this. And it's not like it's something that couldn't have been predicted. I mean, we can look at what it actually says in the Quran about non-believers and how the right hand can possess them, and they are always in a permanent state of war with the non-believers, and if they get a chance, they're perfectly entitled to rape and turn into a sex slave, white girls. And then we can look at the problems that they have with rape over in India. We can see that they have a big problem with it over there with underage rape. So it's not just Muslims, so we can say that it's a non-white issue, particularly in that area, South Asia. Then we can look at what's happened in America recently. The Saudi Arabians that were being trained as pilots, and they were part of the Saudi Arabian Air Force. One of them carried out a terrorist act, but in actual fact, all 20 of them were sent back, and 16 of them had child pornography on their computers. 16 of them, because it's culturally acceptable in these hot countries for them to take wives at the age of 10, 11, 12. And their ideal is Muhammad, who took his wife Aisha when she was 9 years old. And they looked to Muhammad as being the ideal man. So if it was okay for Muhammad to do that, then it's okay for us to do it. And then these people get taken into court, and the judges say, well, because it was culturally acceptable for you to do this, then we can't really prosecute you too much. We can't give you too much of a jail sentence. And that's also happened. We've had judges prosecuting these men more for doing it to their own community rather than doing it to the white community. So it's not like this is something that couldn't have been foreseen. And the people that were speaking up about it, they were accused of being far right. They were accused of being Nazis. They were told it was hate speech, that it was all nonsense. And the police colluded in this by refusing to investigate it. And what needs to be done is the people responsible need to be held to account for this. Nobody's being held to account for this. They're not telling us the name of the chief of police that was responsible for withdrawing these resources. And if he was just acting on instructions from above, then who was it that gave him those instructions? Who was in power at the time? What is it, 2003? Would that have been Blair? Would that have come from the government that they were not to investigate these things? I mean, it reminds me of also in Germany, the police admit and the journalists admit that they are covering up the crimes of the immigrants because they don't want to help the alternative for Deutschland. And they think that if we actually tell the truth, it's going to be helping out the so-called far right. I mean, we've got to stop this.
And again, in terms of the predictability of this, we've only got to look at the photographs of the asylum seekers who are traveling across the Mediterranean in small boats and then traveling across the the British Channel in small boats in order to get to the UK. We've got to look at the photographs of these people to see that something like 90% of the people in those boats are young men of military age. And all sort of racial and cultural things aside, if you have a situation where you create a distorted balance between the number of young women of marriageable age in a society and the number of young men of marriageable age, then you're going to cause problems. And by allowing mass immigration from a foreign country where you are going to have where that immigration consists almost entirely of young men of military age, you are then creating a situation where there is going to be intense competition for female mates. Obviously, the young indigenous British girls are going to prefer their own men. And so that then means that there are going to be large numbers of immigrant men of military age, many of them who've come from a war zone where they've been fighting and killing each other, will suddenly find themselves in Britain and will suddenly find themselves with no outlet for their sexual urges. And, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to actually predict that that's a recipe for a wave of sex crimes to hit the country. And that's exactly what's happened. And as we've said, in order to cover this up, in order to prevent public opinion from recoiling at these the reports of all of these rapes, the police have been obviously instructed. And that's why it's systematic. You know, if they hadn't been instructed, it wouldn't be systematic all over the country. The fact that this has been done systematically all over the country is proof, if anybody needed it, that there were instructions to the police that they were to do this. And so what we need to find out is, and the Home Secretary needs to find out, you know, who the politicians were that instructed the police that this is what they wanted to have happen, and who were the chief police officers that acquiesced to this request, and who then instructed their officers to turn a blind eye, and who were the officers that turned a blind eye knowing that what they were doing was wrong. You know, if we go back to the Nuremberg trials, even the most lowly soldier who was just on guard duty in a concentration camp, even the most lowly clerk who was just doing clerical work in a concentration camp, is being held today responsible for the alleged killings of Jews in those concentration camps. And there is, and what the principle that's being followed here is that the fact that you were given orders is no excuse that anybody out of a sense of humanity should ignore orders and instructions that they know to be immoral and that they know to be illegal, and yet the police officers involved, even at the lowest level, they turned a blind eye knowing that they were effectively not being negligent, they were guilty of malfeasance in a public office. They were guilty of corruption for political purposes.
I think we've got a conspiracy there.
Prosecuted, in my view.
Yeah, I think there's evidence of a conspiracy there, isn't there? I mean, there's an evidence of a conspiracy to defraud the public. I mean, one of the things that really does rub salt into the wound is that they still go on about diversity being a strength. I mean, it wouldn't be so bad if they would admit this and say, well, we have had some problems with multiculturalism, and the grooming gangs is one of them, and that needs to be weighed up against the supposed economic benefits of immigration. But they won't. On the very day that this report came out from Manchester, the Labour Party were signing up to 10 demands of the Muslim Council. I'm not sure if it was the Muslim Council of Great Britain or some Muslim organisation, and Labour making a big do about the fact that they were going to fight so-called Islamophobia and they were going to acquiesce to these 10 demands of Islam. And of course, pointing out that this is an Islamic problem and that the vast majority of the members of these grooming gangs are Muslim, they would say that was Islamophobia. And so instead of standing up for these victims, on the day this report came out, the Labour Party was standing up for the people that carried out these crimes. And of course, they got rid of their MP who spoke about this, who spoke about the ethnic component of it. And, you have to take your hat off to the police lady, actually, that has stuck with this right since 2003. She was accused of being far too emotionally involved. And she's actually stuck with this right the way through until now. And now she's been entirely vindicated. So you can't say that all the police were colluding and went along with this, because some of them didn't. But to move on to this other report that we've got here, there's another report came out from Rotherham that was possibly overlooked with all the publicity about the Manchester one. And this was actually an IOPC complaint that was made by a particular victim of the Rotherham grooming scandal. A woman whose sexual exploitation as a child was ignored by police over fears of increasing racial tensions in Rotherham has said the force aided and abetted the abuse of hundreds of children. The Independent Office for Police Conduct upheld 6 complaints against South Yorkshire Police by a woman abused as a child for several years, starting in 2003. According to a leaked report, first reported by The Times, the watchdog said it was very clear that you were sexually exploited by Asian men and found police were aware of suspects but took insufficient action to prevent you from harm. The woman, who received the 13-page report on Wednesday after first making the complaints in 2014, said children were sacrificed by the failings of the police. She told the PA news agency, "I always thought that maybe the police didn't understand what was happening until I got the report. And now I fully understand that they knew exactly what was going on. How could they do this to hundreds and hundreds of children? How could they go home at night after doing a shift and go to sleep? We were never seen as children that were being abused. They didn't care at all." The woman called for action to be taken against South Yorkshire Police, including potential criminal charges. "They've always been complicit in what happened. We've seen perpetrators get done, so why are they any different? They've aided and abetted abuse," she said. And this line here, that they never saw them as children. I mean, they were encouraged to see these children as if they were prostitutes, as if they were capable of making their own decisions at the age of 12 or 13, once they'd become addicted to heroin and were being forced to sleep with all these strange men. That's the source of it. Do you want to comment on that, Max? I've got another quote here that I can get into after that.
Well, just again, that it's not enough for the IOPC to come forward with pronouncements of the sort they have done, telling us what we've known for virtually 2 decades. What they need to do is to recommend that there is an independent inquiry into this, and an inquiry conducted by people who've got a vested interest in making sure that the inquiry is pursued right through to the point where everybody that was involved is guilty of criminal action in this is brought to justice. And that means that they need to have people from nationalist organisations who have represented the rights of white people over the years. They need to have people of our political persuasion on the investigating committee to make sure that that a blind eye isn't turned again, and that there isn't a whitewash of this situation, because what we've seen is whitewash after whitewash after whitewash, delay and delay and delay. We're now talking about crimes that were committed in the early 2000s, and it's virtually 20 years later before we have admissions on the part of the IOPC that something the police force was failed in its duty. But they haven't seen anybody any use of words like criminal negligence or malfeasance in a public office or widespread corruption for political purposes. Those sort of words are entirely missing from the IOPC's findings. But the IOPC have got a duty, whether or not it was in their original remit to do this. I think the injustices that have occurred to, what could be as many as 1 million young girls, those injustices would warrant the IOPC going beyond its initial remit and recommending prosecutions of the people they found to be to have fallen short of their duty.
Yeah, it's when you think this was going on 20 years ago, and it's obviously it's increased since then. I mean, this is just the tip of the iceberg. In that Manchester report, there was also a police officer that was involved. A police officer's car was actually found there to do with these grooming gangs, and that's not the first time that has happened. So you can't have Muslims investigating Muslims. We need to really, as you say, Max, we need to have representatives of nationalist organisations involved in some kind of investigation like this, and they need to be apologising to the people in the nationalist organisations that were trying to highlight this, that were blowing the whistle, that were saying, look, this is going on in these cities in the north of England. Something needs to be done about it. You know, there needs to be a public apology to the people that were in the BNP at the time. I mean, nothing's being mentioned about that. It's not just these girls that were let down. A lot of people were accused of being racists and just making this stuff up and just hating Muslims. And it wasn't true. They were sick of seeing an injustice, and they were drawing attention to that injustice, which is, you know, that's just the normal, you know, human thing to do, is if you see an injustice, you point it out. If you see a crime happening, you report it. And that's all these people were doing. And they themselves were prosecuted for hate speech for doing it. Well, there was a second investigation included in the report, and the woman's father said an officer referred to grooming as, and this is the wording here, packy shagging, when he phoned the police to discuss his concerns about his daughter. So that shows you the way that the police looked at this. They looked at it as, oh, it's just another incidence of packy shagging. These girls are asking for it, basically, and we're not going to do anything about it. The officer, who was unable to be identified, was also found to have said, with it being Asians, we can't afford for this to be coming out. And he commented that the abuse had been happening for 30 years. The woman told PA she was very upset when reading the report and said, it doesn't matter what colour a perpetrator is, they should all be treated the same. So once again, we see here that we're not all equal under the law. We're supposed to be equal under the law. But if you're non-white, then you can get away with carrying out crimes like this. And if you happen to be white and you point out these crimes that are happening, then you have to be very careful, because you could be the one that is prosecuted for drawing attention to this crime. And I did notice there was a tweet sent out from Based Poland, which gives us an idea of just how rife this is in these communities. And this is just worked out from looking at the numbers. There are 420 Asians that are under investigation for the scandal in Rotherham. And Rotherham has a population of 109,691. The Asian population of Rotherham is 8.3%, which means they make up 9,104 people. Half of that, which would be the males, is 4,552. So there's 4,552 Asian males, and 420 of them are under investigation, which means that 9.23% of the Asian male population in Rotherham are under investigation for sexually abusing white British children. One in ten Muslim males in Rotherham are under investigation for this. This is how rife
when you
this
consider
is
that something like 50% of those Asian males are going to be below the age of 15 themselves. The men above the age of 15 are going to be half again that number, which means that it's not 9%, it's 18% of adult Asian males in that town, statistically, it would seem, have been involved in this kind of activity.
And you think they're also all interrelated, aren't they? Their cousins, uncles, brothers, all the Muslims and the Asians that are in Britain are all interrelated. They all know one another, partly because of the cousin marriage that they have, that they encourage, and also just because of this family reunification thing that we have. So if somebody moves to a country within the EU, they have the right to then bring all their extended family over. So they are all connected up. There is no possible way that the rest of the Muslim community didn't know that this was going on. And this is the difference between when you hear the left and they'll say, oh, yes, well, there are paedophiles in the white community. But the paedophiles in the white community aren't sharing their prey around with their brothers, their uncles, their cousins, and their second cousins. And that's what was going on here. A lot of these people that were arrested for this or that were under investigation for this were all interrelated to one another. And then you think, well, we've also got Muslim counselors, Muslim policemen, and they would have all been related to some of these people that were being investigated. And that gives you some idea of possibly where the encouragement came from for these cases not to be investigated. It probably came from the non-whites that were actually in these important positions that also happened to have cousins that were involved in these gangs or that were involved in drug dealing and knew the people that were involved in this. Again, it's not saying that all these Muslims are involved in this. It's 10% that were doing it. But the other 90% would have known about it. And they weren't coming out and saying, Nick Griffin is correct in what he's saying. They were joining the cries of Islamophobia and racism, and you're just picking on the non-whites here. You know, they weren't saying we've got a problem in our community. In white communities, if there is somebody that is known to be abusing children, that white community will ostracize that person. He will have to move from where he is, and the police will be told about what he's getting up to. That didn't happen in the Muslim community. Again, that's why Britain First are going to these mosques and giving these leaflets out, you know, and they're treating them as saying, well, look, you know, here's your second chance. Yeah. Now you know that this is wrong. Here's your second chance to out these people that are involved in this and bring them to court. We need to stop this. This is a serious problem. And it's not just happening in Britain. It's happening all over Europe. It's a different ethnicity in each country. It's Somalians in Finland. It's Moroccans in Holland. I forget which type it is in France. You know, the common denominator is that they are all Muslim, but they're from different parts of the Islamic world. And this is why the numbers for rape have gone through the roof in places like Sweden. You know, we've got a massive rape problem. And it's being hushed up who the perpetrators are in the interests of again, community cohesion and not causing friction between the communities. And how much does it cost in order to do that? How many resources are put into covering this up rather than just saying to people, well, this is the truth. This is what's happened. And in actual fact, communities are better off separate from one another. You could probably have like a border between two different communities and the ones that did like the diversity and did like getting on with, or got on well with members from another racial community, they would be living on the border. But essentially, you should have segregated communities. If we're going to live in a multicultural country, of course, I would rather that we didn't, but that's the way things are. We can't go back in time. The way to solve these problems is to have segregated communities. Just have the white people living in a community there, the black people living in a community there, the Muslims living in a community there, and you wouldn't have these problems because the Muslims wouldn't be doing this to their own. The blacks do, you know, they do what to their own what they do anyway, and you wouldn't have this friction between them. You wouldn't have these grooming gangs. And if you saw these Muslims in the middle of the white community, they would know that they shouldn't be there. You know, you could call the police and say these people shouldn't be here. They're in the white community, and they would be removed. I mean, it's like that in some of the no-go areas anyway. If you go to a no-go area and you're white, you can be asked, you all be asked to leave by the people that are there. I mean, people self-segregate like that anyway. Birds of a feather flock together. It's natural for us to want to live with our extended family rather than wanting to live around other peoples that have different cultural ideas, different ways that they behave, different laws to us. I mean, this is a thing, totally different laws to us. If you look at Egypt and Saudi Arabia, I mean, if a woman gets raped, that's her fault. She's the one that goes to court for seducing the man, basically, for causing the man to lose control of his emotions and rape her. That's the way that it's looked at over there. And I'm not saying we should be interfering in Saudi Arabia and Egypt and changing that. That's what they've developed. But we don't want that over here. And if we have to have these people over here, they need to be kept separate from us. It's so simple. It's not about hating these other races. It's just about what's best for everyone. So I say nationalism is best for everyone. Segregation is best for everyone. It's so simple. It's such a simple solution to this problem that we're throwing all these resources at, and that, you know, when you suggest it, you're made out to be a horrible racist. In actual fact, it's the opposite of hating other races, because it would mean that they are free to express themselves in the cultural ways that is specific to their people, instead of being forced to try and live in the same way that white people live.
I think from a simple law and order perspective, any situation where police officers see middle-aged men with teenage girls, underage teenage girls that are perhaps 12, 13, 14 years of age, that should be a warning sign without anything else. You know, irrespective of any kind of cultural or racial issues, if you see middle-aged men with young girls, that is a warning sign. And we've only got to look at things like, you know, the Jeffrey Epstein scandal to see, you know, there you had a middle-aged man who had his madame procuring teenage girls, underage teenage girls in many cases, to perform sexual favors for his very wealthy friends and associates. And you've only got to look at the recently released film about the Profumo scandal with Christine Keeler and Mandy Rice Davies. You know, the Profumo scandal was really all about the trafficking of, in this case, not underage girls in that case, but still very young and inexperienced girls to rich and powerful men. But the, you know, what's been going on in the Asian community is that it's not been done on a very sort of small scale, where only involving rich and powerful men. It's been done on a on an industrial scale, with hundreds in, you know, each large town and city involved in it, and like tens of thousands of perpetrators, if you count all the occurrences all across the country. And as far as the victims are concerned, and as you said earlier on, estimates as high as, you know, possibly a million young girls might have been involved in this. And if you consider a million girls, for example, each year in the UK there is approximately 275,000 girls born. Now, the total number of children born in any year in the UK is around about 550,000 to 600,000. So let's say it's 300,000 in any one year. So if there are a million girls involved, that's 3 years worth of girls have been sexually abused by these grooming gangs. And when you consider that, you know, childhood is 18 years, if you divide 3 into 18, that's kind of indicating that possibly as many as 1 in 6 girls in this country below the age of 18 have actually become a victim of one of these grooming gangs. And so it is an absolutely enormous problem, and it's not a problem that should be ignored for political reasons.
You would think that, you know, if the police saw a white girl with somebody that was non-white, they could now investigate. That could be reason enough. You know, like they have the stop and search in London, and if they see somebody that they think might be carrying a knife or they might be carrying drugs, they can, you know, they can stop and search them. And they should be something like this. And the Muslim community should be welcoming it. They should be welcoming it. They should be saying, well, we want to get these, you know, these bad sorts. We want them to be tried. We don't want to be associated with them. Please do this. If you see any white girls with these non-whites, we want you to arrest them. We want you to investigate them. But, you know, I haven't seen any sign that the police are going to be doing anything like that. That, of course, they would be accused of racial profiling if they did. But this pattern is so obvious. And, you know, the solution to it is so obvious as well. But because of political correctness, that their hands are tied behind their back, they're coming out with all these platitudes and, oh, we're so sorry about it. But where's the action? That's what we need to see. We need to see some action on this. Well, I've got.
And it doesn't have to be racial profiling, actually, because the point I made earlier on is that you do not normally see young girls of 12, 13, and 14 going out and going to nightclubs or going to parties with men of middle age. And so it's not a matter that the police have to single out Asians in this respect. All they've got to do is to single out, where they see an instance of a middle-aged man and a girl in her early teens, that's a screamingly obvious, something is going wrong here. This is a normal situation and they need to look into it. And so there is no excuse. They can't use the excuse, oh, no, that would be racial profiling. All they've got to do is focus. If they see middle-aged men with teenage girls, then they need to act.
Good point. And anybody that's quite innocently out, they should be quite happy to have that happen, because it means that other young girls are kept safe. It's simple solutions, and we just really need to hear the politicians speaking about it and doing something about it, instead of, as I say, Labour going on about how they've acquiesced to all of Muslims' demands. On this actual day. Now, I've got some positive news stories here as well, and we haven't actually got a Greatest Britain to talk about this week, but we have got some Great Britons that are around today. And this news story caught my eye last week. It's about three white brothers from Scotland have set three world records after rowing the Atlantic Ocean in just 35 days. Jamie Ewan and Lachlan McLean are the first three brothers to row any ocean, and the youngest trio and the fastest trio to ever row the Atlantic. They set off from La Gomera in the Canary Islands on 12th of December and have now completed the 3,000-mile trip to Antigua. Previously, the fastest the trio had ever rowed the Atlantic Ocean was 41 days, so they did it 6 days faster than the previous record. They had to row the last 20 days without any music, podcasts, or audiobooks, as their iPhone cables succumbed to damage caused by a combination of sun and seawater. However, being musicians, they kept themselves entertained with bagpipes, harmonica, and a ukulele that they had on board. Jamie and Lachlan, students at the Glasgow University and Glasgow School of Art respectively, convinced their brother Ewan, a design engineer for Dyson in Bristol, to take a sabbatical from work to make this world record attempt. The 27-year-old said, "They had to twist my arm, but I will be forever grateful to my brothers for convincing me to do this. This was, without doubt, the defining experience of my life. It was incredibly difficult, but the way we came together, the way our bodies and minds coped with every single challenge, will stay with me for a long time. It definitely tested our relationship, but it was remarkable how we were able to lift each other up as we struggled. It's brought us closer together, although I am looking forward to getting to see and talk to some different people." You know, I think that's incredible that, you just get three brothers together and they say, well, let's do this. Let's get out there and we'll do it. And, there are still things left that white people can do. We've talked about the pioneering and the people going over to South Africa, people going over to America and discovering New Zealand and discovering Australia. There are still challenges out there that people can do. And, to see these three lads coming in on their boat, there was like the oldest one was there playing his bagpipes as they came in with all these fireworks going off. And, there are still these things that can be done and people still do appreciate it. I mean, I don't know if there are very many non-whites that actually have the idea of actually going for a world record and trying to beat it. It seems to be something that white people do. We just love to have a challenge and we want to be the best at it. This really, I think, showcases what's best about white people. And that there are still things that still challenges out there that people can do. Did you hear about this at all, Max? It was featured quite a lot on the television last week.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's a great example of the character of our people, that we can still produce young men who rise to a challenge and who have the a burning passion to explore and to involve themselves in adventures. And these three brothers are obviously three young men who, because of their closeness, are find their company easy and who fit together and who work together and who have achieved something really significant in what they've done. And I think that, the playing of bagpipes is something which is symbolic, really, of their national heritage. The fact that they are obviously, I think, Scottish from the look of their names, and the fact that they were playing bagpipes made the accomplishment that they had a celebration, really, of them and the ethnicity from which they come.
Well, this is the point. They were Scots, and the Scots are known for being very hardy. So this is an example of the differences that we have between the racial nations that make up the United Kingdom. And this is something that the Scots are known for doing. And I've got another story here. And again, this involves
I think before you go on, what I'd like to say is that a lot of people criticise British people from past generations for the fact that we went out and we explored the world and we charted the world, etc. But the spirit shown by these three brothers is very, very is drawn from the same tradition,
but they're not out there trying to rip off, trying to rip off the Indians or trying to get what they can from the Africans. The spirit that drove them to do this was the challenge.
They're doing it for adventure. Yeah. That's right, the challenge and the adventure.
Yeah, it's that spirit that we still have. It's the same spirit that our ancestors had, and that's the spirit, I think, that that the British Empire had originally. It wasn't about, enslaving other races. It was just about this spirit of adventure and pioneering and colonizing and going where no man has gone before, basically, which is what these three were doing. Do you want to add anything else to that, Max? I've got another rowing man or sailing man from Scotland here to bring up.
No, I've got nothing else to add to that. No, carry on.
Well, as I say, it's something that seems to be within Scots in particular, because there was another Scottish man. He was actually part of a six-man team, and they actually broke a load of world records, and they became the first to cross Drake's Passage unassisted. And his father was actually the first man to fly above Everest. So this shows you that, genes pass in the family, the same as musicianship passes its way down to the descendants. This spirit of adventure passes its way down to the descendants as well. The team of men from four countries finished crossing Drake's Passage on Wednesday in just under 2 weeks after pushing off from the southern tip of South America. This is a really big deal in Antarctic history to hear about this, said Wayne Ranney, a Flagstaff, Arizona-based geologist who has led expeditions to Antarctica and crossed the Drake Passage in motorized vessels more than 50 times. 100% of their progress was done with those 12 arms for 600 nautical miles. That is just phenomenal. I can't even imagine. Besides the threat to their lives, the men laboured under gruelling conditions. Their 29-foot rowing boat, named the Ohana, had to be in constant motion to avoid capsizing. That meant the three men would row for 90 minutes while the other three rested, still cold and wet. You're rowing inside an open hold, 40-foot sea waves are splashing in your face, near-freezing water is splashing over the bow, said 35-year-old Colin O'Brady of Jackson Hole, Wyoming, one of the six men on the boat. It was quite harrowing, O'Brady told the Associated Press on Thursday in his first interview after the journey. By the end, we all lost a good amount of weight and were delirious from the sleep deprivation. The men had to use a bucket to go to the bathroom. I don't know why they always tell us that. I mean, they're surrounded by the sea. What do they expect people to use? Carry a fully functioning toilet on board or something? It's just so obvious, isn't it?
Absolutely.
To rest, two men needed to lie shoulder to shoulder in a tiny space while a third would lay in a fetal position in an even smaller area. You're curled up and jammed into a small space, trying to get a few winks of sleep before the alarm would go off and boom, you're back at it again, O'Brady said. The toughest part for O'Brady's fellow rower, Jamie Douglas Hamilton of Edinburgh, Scotland, he's the one who's the grandson of the first man to fly over Mount Everest, was the constant bombardment from the elements. We were hit by winds from every single direction, and the seas down here are very violent. It is the roughest ocean in the world, the 38-year-old said. We almost capsized many times, and the problem with that is the water is so cold that if you go in, you've probably only got 2 to 5 minutes to live. Physically, Douglas Hamilton said he fought crippling seasickness and numb hands and feet. At one point, a strap he had to wear around his ankles while rowing wore through his boots and cut into his skin all the way to the bone. It was absolute agony, Douglas Hamilton said. The other men on the expedition were Fionn Paul of Reykjavik, Iceland, Cameron Bellamy of Cape Town, South Africa, Andrew Town of Grand Forks, North Dakota, and John Peterson of Oakland, California. Paul Douglas Hamilton and Bellamy are record-breaking ocean rowers. Town is a championship rower and has climbed the tallest mountain on every continent, and Peterson was a championship college rower. This row represents one of the most significant human-powered adventures ever undertaken, and a number of records were established as a result. Number one, first row on the Southern Ocean. Number two, first row across Drake's Passage. Number three, first row to the Antarctic continent. Number four, southernmost start of a rowing expedition. Number five, southernmost latitude reached by a rowing vessel. Number six, youngest person to row on the Southern Ocean. Number seven, oldest person to row on the Southern Ocean. Number eight, first ocean rower to complete the Ocean Explorer's Grand Slam. And number nine, most polar open water rows completed by a rower. So like a real endurance test there by these men. And of course, they're all white men. I mean, I don't think you would be able to find a black man that would be prepared to go through all those hardships. I mean, you imagine they're just rowing the whole time. That's the only power that they've got to travel 600 nautical miles, just rowing all the time for 90 minutes and then trying to sleep for 90 minutes with the freezing cold spray hitting them, getting all the way to the Antarctic. You know, it's just incredible that, you know, we have these men that are just so adventurous. And
if you read the accounts of seafarers, you know, that they refer to Cape Horn as being, and rounding Cape Horn as being, one of the most dangerous maneuvers you can possibly do. Well, these people didn't just round Cape Horn. They rowed from Cape Horn and rowed south of Cape Horn into rougher seas and stronger winds than most sailors would have actually thought was sensible. And they carried on going until they had completed the crossing, which is absolutely remarkable. And it sort of reminds me of an occasion when I went to a presentation that was made by Ranulf Fiennes after he had completed one of his, I think it was a transantarctic expedition. And he was reporting then about how it was bitterly cold. He was on his own. He was dragging a sled with, you know, his supplies and provisions on it. And by the end of the journey, he had got frostbite in his feet and ended up losing several of his toes. And what these people in this particular instance did was that they showed they had that same grit and that same courage to keep on going, even when they were in physical pain, because the challenge made it worthwhile. And it's a thing that I was going to mention earlier on, and I couldn't quite sort of get my head around the actual words to sort of to say it, was that back in the 70s, most people would have been that would have watched television would have been familiar with the Star Trek series that was on, that always began, "Space, the Final Frontier, to boldly go where no man has gone before." Well, you know, these people are not going into outer space, but they're going into spaces where no man has gone before, and they're doing things that no man has done before. And I think that is absolutely remarkable. And just as the Star Trek series kind of inspired lots of young people to think about outer space and space travel and things of that sort, so I think that the exploits of the people involved, you know, both groups, the young lads that rowed across the Atlantic, and these people who crossed Drake's Passage, you know, they are people who should be an inspiration to other young people in our country, and hopefully they will be, and hopefully more young people as the years go by will take on similar challenges and excel and enjoy the adventure of doing so.
Well, hopefully they would speak to students, you should imagine they would have them speaking to schools and have speaking engagements from this. And it's a particularly male drive, isn't it? You know, to see a challenge, and you know, you've just got to do it. You see a mountain and you want to climb it. You see the sea and you want to make your way across it. You see the channel and you want to be the first person to swim it. There are still all these records that are there, and it's something particularly masculine and particularly Aryan to want to go out and do this. I mean, we are the people that discovered all the rest of the world, that went out in our ships and mapped these islands and brought civilization to the peoples that were there. It wasn't the other way around. They didn't come to us. We went to them.
I also think that there are some women that like to do this sort of thing as well. You know, Amelia Earhart flew across the Atlantic. I think she was the first woman to fly across the Atlantic. I think she may have been the first woman to fly around the world as well. I can't quite remember exactly her full list of achievements. So I wouldn't necessarily say it's just a purely masculine thing. I think perhaps it's a predominantly masculine thing, but there are lots of women who have got that same drive to go on adventures as well.
There are always exceptions to the rule, but the thing is, I mean, if you're going to be talking about the fastest to do something, it's always going to be the men that break that world record, just because we have a third more body strength. But yeah, there are always exceptions to the rule. There are women that achieve great things, mainly having large families, I would suggest, is a wonderful thing for a woman to do. Well, we've almost reached the end here, Max. There was something else that you wanted to bring up, I think. So, was it something to do with the Labour Party that you noticed last week, just before we finish?
Well, yeah, it's just that one of the things that I think it has kind of been airbrushed out was the fact that at the last general election, obviously the Labour Party lost by a considerable margin, and it's lots of people put forward their reasons. Lots of people who are the Labour, the hopefuls of taking over the Labour Party leadership, have put forward their reasons as to why they felt that Labour lost. But not one of them has mentioned that one of the factors involved in Labour losing the general election was the fact that there had been a persistent campaign of smearing the Labour Party with accusations of anti-Semitism. And so it kind of surprised me when I learnt this weekend that the Labour leadership hopefuls have all agreed, I think all apart from Angela Thornberry, I think, have agreed so far to take part in a Labour leadership debate that's to be held in the JW3 building, I think it is, in London, in around about the middle of February. And it just strikes me as strange that when you consider that the Jewish community in Britain constitutes only 0.5% of the population, and when you consider that there has been this consistent campaign on the part of many Jewish leaders to smear the Labour Party over the last 4 years or so, and that must have been a significant factor in Labour losing the general election, that the Labour candidates are going to give these people, or to give the Jewish community rather, a private viewing of their presentations relating to their bid to become the new Labour leader. I would have thought that the Labour Party would have wanted to address the largest audience possible, and so therefore to gain the support of the largest number of people in the country for their future bids to become the government in this country, and not just to restrict themselves to a group that has the leadership of which has been especially vitriolic in smearing the Labour Party.
And such a tiny percentage. You know, it's just 2% of the population there, and yet they're getting a special leadership challenge just for them, where they can ask the Labour leadership just what they're going to do for Jews. You know, as you pointed out to me before we went on air, Max, you know, probably the caravanning club of Great Britain's probably got more people than the Jews. Why aren't they going to the caravanning club of Great Britain and giving them a special private leadership challenge. It just shows you how much...
The people of Northern Ireland as well, you know, it would make more sense for the Labour leadership hopefuls to go and speak to the people of Northern Ireland or the people of Wales or the people of Scotland. Any of those would tend to make more sense, unless, of course... it's felt by those Labour leadership hopefuls that the Jewish community has, despite its small numbers, got a disproportionately greater amount of influence in our society than the people of Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, for example. But of course, under the definition of anti-Semitism that the Jewish community have been promoting in recent times, to actually suggest such a thing would be regarded by them as anti-Semitism. But
that's what's implied, isn't it?
That's what's implied. But it's you can't have your cake and eat it. You know, either you are a small group in society who don't have any disproportionate amount of influence, in which case the Labour Party would probably ignore you in the way that they've ignored the Caravan Club and the people of Wales and the people of Northern Ireland, etc., and not given them their own special leadership debate. Or you are a group that does have a disproportionately large amount of influence in society. And I'll leave our listeners to make their own mind up as to which one of those is the case.
I think it's quite clear, isn't it? Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Max. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Don't forget, we do have a Bitcoin wallet and we do require your donations to keep Radio Albion going. And you can find that on every page at radioalbion.com. We will be back next week with more Aryan Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.